Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Richard Campanella, whose new book is The Cottage on Chapatoulas, a historical geography of uptown New Orleans. We'll also hear from Elisa Marie Speranza, whose new novel is The Italian Prisoner. When you need to know the history of a particular piece of land or an unusual building in New Orleans, who are you going to call? Probably Richard Campanella, the Associate Dean for Research of the Tulane School of Architecture and the author of 11 books and more than 200 articles on the culture, geography, and architecture of our city. I think of you as our geographer-in-chief, Rich. Today we're talking with him about his new book, The Cottage on Chapatoulas, a historical geography of uptown New Orleans, which the Preservation Resource Center has just published. Rich, welcome back.
Thank you.
A book from you is always an occasion. So this to me seems like one of those great stories that's been hiding in plain sight.
Well put. Many folks know that ancient-looking little white cottage as you negotiate the corner of Chapatoulas and Henry Clay right by Children's Hospital. And the first thing you notice is that great big orange-reddish brick wall there surrounding the old Marine Hospital site. And this book is about that building and its site.
There's this poet, Albert Goldbarth, who said something along the lines of, anything gripped aright and studied long will reveal the history of the universe. So it's sort of like if you just wrestle with something down to every detail, you'll know everything you should know. And that's the way you are with this place and this part of the city. It goes all the way back to the very beginning to the present day.
And really farther back to the underlying geography and geology. If you just think of as Chapatoulas approaches Henry Clay, next time you're there, if you're out walking about, look toward the river from that intersection, and you could actually see the land, riverside of Chapatoulas, by a couple of feet start to dip down. So Chapatoulas was the crest of the natural levee, and 300 years ago, the main channel of the river was much, much closer, practically under the new parking garage at the site, right across on the main entrance of Children's Hospital. And so what has happened, like throughout much of uptown and even parts of downtown, the river has shifted to lean more into the west bank, which means that the current runs slack on the east bank, the Point Bar, sediment deposited out, a batcher formed, and the levee, the artificial levee, was moved further and further out. And at one point in the 1880s, fill was brought in to level it off. But they didn't level it off perfectly, because to this day, you could still see the land decrease slightly, even riverside of Chapatoulas, as well as landside.
Wow. And there are so many hard things to pin down about this house, like the exact date of its construction.
Yeah. You have to come to term with a fluidity of construction date and location. So just the basics on the structure. It is mostly a product of the early 1830s, okay? So it is a white cottage with two wings and a front gallery facing the river with a hipped roof and a center chimney. It has older Creole aspects to it with no hallway and rooms that abut each other without the use of a hallway. But it also has 19th century classical and Greek revival elements. The inner bones of it, according to my colleagues in architecture, probably date to the very end of the 18th century. So 1780s, 1790s, and we could talk about the Etienne Boré era when he first. But they were probably recycled timber frames. This was done all the time. A building is dismantled, they reuse the beams. And rebuilt the inner rooms in the early 1830s and then augmented in the 1850s to give it its current visage. It's also been moved at least three times. So in writing this book and tying the structural chronology to the site history, I had to juggle that nuance. You know, I can't at any one point say that the building is now 50 years old because it had multiple birthdays.
Right. So talk a little bit about its role as a Marine hospital, because it was a Marine hospital for a really long time.
Yeah. The Marine hospital, the whole concept is an early example of American public health. Right. It comes out of a 1790s law that required the that entailed that the U.S. government provide health care to anyone who works on the water, mariners, seamen, even fishermen. I didn't realize this. So they would sail from port to port, and if they became ill, they didn't have a home to go to and didn't necessarily have a doctor to go to, so they went to the Marine Hospital. And so every great port city had a Marine Hospital. We had one in Gratna that exploded under very mysterious circumstances in the opening months of the Civil War when the Confederacy was using it to store gunpowder, and eventually came to the present-day medical district. Then in 1883, federal government was shopping for a nice, airy, breezy place on the river, since these were mariners, and found the perfect place in the old Fourche brickyard, which was the land use there that the house we're talking about here became the overseer's house.
And Polycarp Fourche.
Polycarp Fourche.
I love that name.
Right,
Polycarp.
Right. Who bought it from the Buth family, which had Buthville, that neighborhood laid out. But that didn't include the brickyard. So Polycarp Fourche operated in the late 1850s up until the Civil War, a very productive brickmaking operation there. And this was an enslaved brickyard. We tend to think of plantation slavery as being agricultural field hands, but these were enslaved people in manufacturing. And clear into the 1920s, 1930s, I could show you aerial photos and you could see the slave cabins.
Wow.
Right immediately parallel to the brick wall across from Children's Hospital. And the cottage on Chapultepec was the overseer's house. So the Marine Hospital is built in first in 1883. And then in the 1930s, it's modernized. So most of the old buildings are cleared away with the exception of the cottage and a couple of other buildings. And Albert Davis Taylor, the architect and landscape architect who also did the landscaping around the Pentagon, did the planning for the present day structures. And they really did a beautiful job. There's that spectacular cupola. And so that was the Marine Hospital that operated in 1981. And to come full circle here, Dr. Stephen Hales and Nancy Hales, the architect, who's his wife, they started their career, Dr. Hales being the very well-known pediatrician, at what is now Children's Hospital and the old Marine Hospital, and lived on site there. And so all these years later, they have funded its restoration.
What surprised you about this?
Well, one of the things that surprised me was that, you know, when you go to that area there, you're about as high and dry as you can get in New Orleans. You know, you're 11 or 12 feet above sea level. You're close to the river. But the fact that it was in the river and mostly, you know, filled batcher that had to be reclaimed and controlled gave a sense of dynamism to what I had previously perceived to be the, you know, relatively rock solid, to overuse, to overstate, natural levee. And so the fact that fill was brought in and it was brought up there brought a geographical dynamism that you also see in the architectural dynamics of this house that has transformed and moved so many times.
But all the different kinds of people that have passed through that site.
Yeah,
it's astonishing, you know?
Yeah.
From the earliest Iberville and then slaves,
indigenous before them.
The indigenous people. Yeah. That was fascinating too.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, we don't like so much of prehistory here. It's hard to get site specific on this. But the Chapultepec area comes up in colonial literature repeatedly, and what it referred to, no one's quite sure if it was the name of a tribe or a name of an encampment or the name of a geographical feature, namely the really sharp bend of the Mississippi River across from Nine Mile Point, what is now the parish line. Mm-hmm. But it's repeatedly referred to because of its riverine prominence. And so the road to the Chapultepec coast ends up becoming today's Chapultepec Street. Another angle to this of the ethnicity that was brought together at this spot is Charles Guyare recalls one of some of the most exciting moments growing up in his youth there, which would have been the 18 teens, okay, mm-hmm. was when the Mexican cowboys came galloping through. And remember, you know, what did the Spanish call Chapultepec Street? They called it Camino Real. It was mm-hmm. the Royal Road. And it took you, you know, through many convolutions. It took you westward. And it took you to southwestern Louisiana, which was Spanish domain. Texas was part of Mexico. Mexico was part of New Spain. And so these Mexican cowboys would come bringing horses with them for sale. They would gather up a large herd, travel eastward, sell them off, and then work their way back. And he describes them as all outfitted in their charros and so forth.
Yeah. You just, I would love to be inside your head just once, looking at a piece of property, because all the images you can summon up are so revelatory and real, and you must see New Orleans through this haze of history all the time.
Yeah, well, I could bring you to parking lots and talk your ear off for 3 hours. I have victims who can attest to that.
No, I don't think it's that bad. But I'd go and I'd learn something. And yet, between the two of us, can we get Chapultepec to be properly spelled and pronounced? I don't know.
I actually find it quite phonetic, except for half the letters, I suppose.
Well, I love it. It's one of my favorite street names. We've been talking with Richard Campanella, whose new book is The Cottage on Chapultepec, A Historical Geography of Uptown New Orleans. Signed copies of the book will be available during the Preservation Resource Center's Shotgun House Tour, June 11th through 12th, with the Cottage on Chapultepec featured on the tour and open to the public. Information at prcno.org. Rich, thank you so much.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Lisa Marie Speranza is a Boston native who moved to New Orleans in 2002. She currently divides her time between New Orleans and Massachusetts. In her new book, the novel The Italian Prisoner, she tells a fascinating story right out of New Orleans history, the story of a young woman working in the Higgins factory during World War II and her wartime romance with an Italian prisoner of war, one of 1,000 held at Jackson Barracks. Elisa, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
This is such a fascinating story, but tell us about the time you discovered its real-life beginnings.
It was totally by accident. Chef Joel Feroldi, who owns Lakeview Burgers and Seafood, was catering an event back in 2003, and he and I were chatting about growing up Italian and comparing stories, and he said, "My family was a little different. My dad was an Italian prisoner of war, and my mom was a local Sicilian girl in the French Quarter." And he kept talking. I went, wait.
Did you start to take notes right then and there?
Exactly. I couldn't believe it was a story I had never heard about New Orleans or about my Italian heritage or about the war. It started a huge treasure hunt that went on for many years.
And talk about the research you did, which was extraordinary because you had to dive into so many different areas.
Yeah, it was very interesting, and I have to give proper due respect to Sal Cirio, who was the curator of the American Italian Research Library, who passed away just last week suddenly, and we're all very sad about that.
I know. I was going to ask if you wanted to say a few words about him.
Yeah, and without Sal, he held the key to a lot of the information that that led to the story, including how to reach the families and the descendants of those Jackson Barracks POWs and the local Sicilian women that they met and married. So that was the beginning, and a lot of the research actually was done from talking to those families and oral histories, and then a bunch of other threads that I didn't expect to encounter but were fascinating, like the Higgins Shipyard itself was a story into itself.
Right. So tell us about Sal's archive, as it were.
Sal has always been the go-to guy, and I honestly don't know who will replace him for genealogy research in the greater New Orleans area and helping people find their Sicilian, mostly Sicilian in our area, roots, and, you know, putting their family trees together. But he also has a huge collection over there at the East Jefferson Parish Library of artifacts. And when I went to see him, he had a folder full of photographs and articles about the Jackson Barracks POWs. And he smiled and said, "I've been waiting years for someone to ask me about this." And a great partnership was born. It's a great resource. And I know there are a lot of people who care about it. So I hope that it'll continue as a resource for folks.
So much of the novel is spent recreating wartime New Orleans, and that's such a fascinating period. So talk about some of that research.
Yeah, it was very interesting to kind of immerse myself in what I wanted to know what it was like living in wartime. A part of this novel was written during COVID lockdown, so I had a little bit of an inkling
of sure.
the hardships of rationing and the kind of existential threats, but I didn't know that there had been U-boats right in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, and sinking merchant ships. So people really felt the war very very present in their lives every day. And, of course, there was great loss as so many sons and daughters of New Orleans went off to war and never came back.
And the Sicilian population that lived here was so vital and so lively and energetic and took over part of the French Quarter. Talk about your protagonist a bit and creating her.
Yes, and outside of New Orleans, a lot of people don't even know that there was such a huge Sicilian and Italian presence in New Orleans, so much so that they called the Lower French Quarter Little Palermo, and mm-hmm. the mayor of New Orleans at the time, Mayor Maestri, he was Sicilian himself. So learning more about that Sicilian history was fascinating. And then seeing the remnants of that history, you know, even in our culture and our life today with St. Joseph's Day, of course, and with the corner groceries and the grocery store where my protagonist's family runs and lives in the French Quarter is really modeled after Matassa's at the corner of St. Philip and Dauphine. And, of course, the St. Mary's Italian Church is right there. Mm-hmm. And luckily for me, the French Quarter looks much as it did at that time. So walking around the French Quarter and kind of the sights and smells and sounds, of course, there's no streetcar down there anymore, but I had a lot to work with.
That's one of the best things about New Orleans is that you can walk around inside your book, inside your head,
exactly.
you know?
Exactly.
So tell us about Rose. Yes.
Yeah, Rose. She works at the Higgins Shipyard. There was no, that was a totally made-up story, although 85,000 people worked at the Higgins Shipyards, all seven of them by the end of the war, in an integrated workforce, which was another fascinating tidbit. I wanted her to be a working girl, even though none of the real-life people that I encountered were working at the shipyard, but I imagine a lot of New Orleans women went off to work there for the first time outside the home or outside the family business. The shipyard itself was such a major force in the New Orleans area and in the country and in the war mm-hmm. During that time. So Rose, as I envisioned her, was a very petite young woman and wasn't cut out to be Rosie the Riveter. Her friend Marie was more like that, but luckily, there was a bookkeeping job for her at the shipyard, and that's where she went to work.
And women's lives at that time were changing so quickly because of the war, and Rose is not immune to that.
Absolutely. And the more I wrote and learned and read about the lives of women that did go off to work in the war industries, and the fact that not all of them wanted to go back to the kitchen when the men came back, and they were happy to have a few dollars in their pockets that they couldn't have had otherwise. The women were paid pretty fairly, which was a little surprising to me, too. And I think that really influenced, when I read some of those firsthand stories from those women, it really influenced Rose's character as she went along and grew up and grew a little more mature in her ambitions.
Well, there's something so wonderful about this book because it is, in some ways, a very traditional book. And you think it's going along certain traditional lines, and then all of a sudden, whoops.
Yes.
No, that's not the way it's going to go. And that was really kind of wonderful thing about it.
Thank you. Yes, I couldn't have it be too predictable. And
yeah.
I know that there were lots of stories during that time and lots of stories that I was able to draw on from folks I knew in my own life, because life doesn't always go down the predictable path.
Mm-hmm. And I have to say, this is a novel that made me so hungry.
Oh, good. That's great.
So yeah. When you do the Italian prisoner recipe book.
Oh, that's a great idea.
I'm telling you, you laid the groundwork.
Oh, that's a great idea. In fact, I had to be corrected because in the Italian tradition, we have things like the seven fishes on Christmas Eve, and I learned very quickly that was not a Sicilian tradition, so I had to swap out some of the food and make sure it was period correct and ethnically correct as well.
So what's next for you?
I'm working on book number two, and it will be from the point of view of one of the characters in this book as well.
Ah.
The story of the POWs is another whole thread, because all over the country, there were 51,000 Italian POWs throughout the United States, and in various cities where there were Italian populations, like there were in New Orleans, they too had interactions with mm-hmm. Italian prisoners. So I'm having fun finding those stories as well and getting to talk to some of those folks.
Well, don't you find that many people are just surprised to find there were prisoners of war in New Orleans?
Absolutely. They're surprised at that, as I was. Even people who consider themselves history buffs didn't know about that. The other thing that people forget is that Italy switched sides in the war in September of 43, which I had totally forgotten, and they joined the Allies. So now these guys were in limbo. They were captives. They couldn't be sent back to Italy because the war was still raging there. And yet they weren't a threat to anybody either. So I think that was part of the reason they were allowed out to socialize and to work and to interact with the local population.
We've been talking with Elisa Speranza, whose new novel is The Italian Prisoner, perfect for your summer reading list. Elisa, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Susan. It was my pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Ladder Library Poetry Buffet features Stacey Balkin, Nicole Iden, Marion Moore, and Allison Pellegrin, reading Saturday, June 4th at 2. Check out the Facebook page for the Zoom link. Emma Soames, Winston Churchill's granddaughter, discusses and signs her mother's diaries, Mary Churchill's War, the wartime diaries of Churchill's youngest daughter, Sunday, June 5th from 3 to 5 at Garden District Bookshop. This is a ticketed event. Tickets available at Eventbrite and Garden District Bookshop. Clay McLeod reads from and signs his horror novel, Whisper Down the Lane, Friday, June 3rd at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. Blue Cypress Books hosts a launch event for the New Orleans Art Rag, a new arts journal that focuses on Louisiana creators. That's Friday, June 3rd at 6 till 7:30. That great annual event, the Symphony Book Fair, is back and begins Friday, June 3rd through Sunday, June 5th at the University of New Orleans Lakefront Arena. Enter the sale under Ramp 1, which faces Franklin Avenue. Hours are Friday, 9 to 8, admission from 9 to 3 only, free admission after 3. Then Saturday from 9 to 8 and Sunday from 9 to 4 with no admission charge. Books include fiction and nonfiction in 50 categories, sheet music and recordings, LPs, CDs, DVDs, and audiobooks, as well as art, both posters and original works. There will be a special children's sale Sunday from 11 to 2. Proceeds support the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra. The 7th annual Walker Percy Weekend takes place June 3rd through 5th in St. Francisville, complete with beer, bourbon, barbecue, and lots of great conversation. Check out walkerpercyweekend.org for tickets. New additions to the schedule include a screening of Jason Barry's film, City of a Million Dreams. Speakers this year include Chris Baglow of Notre Dame, Jody Blanco, co-author of I, John Kennedy Toole, John Shelton Reed, author of On Barbecue, and Reed Mercer Shushart, who will discuss the many movies of the moviegoer. Richard Campanella's new book, The Cottage on Chapatoulas, A Historical Geography of Uptown New Orleans, debuts during the Preservation Resource Center Shotgun House Tour, June 11th through 12th, with the cottage on Chapultepec at the corner of Henry Clay featured on the tour and open to the public. Information at prcno.org. And coming up, the June Writers Seminar, Sex and Voodoo at the Library. Two New Orleans authors present sessions to help local writers be better at their craft from 9:30 to 12:30, Saturday, June 11th at the North Kenner Library at 630 Esplanade in Kenner. Each session is free of charge, open to the public, no registration. Mystery writer Greg Herron discusses how to write a sex scene and when not to at 9:30 a.m., followed by Khalila Smith discussing what every writer should know about voodoo and the occult. That's at 11 a.m. The Jefferson Parish Library's summer reading program, Oceans of Possibilities, begins June 4th and runs through July 31st. Events are free of charge and open to the public with no registration. A children's summer reading kickoff party takes place at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie and West Bank Regional Library on Manhattan Boulevard in Harvey from noon to 3, Saturday, June 4th. Families can register for the summer reading program and take part in mermaid crafts and activities with special guests, the Sirens of New Orleans. Check out all the public libraries for summer reading fun. All branches offer some variety of story times, reading and writing groups, both for kids and adults. The New Orleans Public Library branches have a full schedule as well. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.